You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello everyone, I'm Matthew Taylor, I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. It's my great pleasure to welcome you here today for today's special lunchtime talk. Now, my job occasionally has just secret pleasures in it, and a secret pleasure was that the person who was going to share this event couldn't do it, and so I was asked to do it. And so I've been immersing myself in the ideas in this book in the last 24 hours, and what a thrill it's been. It's absolutely fantastic. So it's brilliant to be chairing this event, and you've chosen a great event to come to. And it's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Neil Shubin. Professor Shubin is a paleontologist in the great tradition of his mentors, Ernst Mayr and Stephen Jay Gould. He's discovered fossils around the world that have changed the way we think about many of the key transitions in evolution, and has pioneered a new synthesis of expeditionary paleontology, developmental genetics, and genomics. He trained at Columbia, Harvard, and Berkeley, and is currently Distinguished Service Professor and Associate Dean of Biological Sciences at the University of Chicago. He's the author of the best-selling and award-winning Your Inner Fish, which delved into the amazing connections between human anatomy and the structures in the fish that first took over land 375 million years ago. But his new book, The Universe Within, Neil takes an even more expansive approach to the question of why we are the way we are, this time showing how the entirety of the universe's 14 billion year history can be seen in our bodies. Absolutely fascinating. So without further ado, can I ask you to welcome Neil Shubin.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. I'm delighted to be here, and thank you all for being here. What I'm going to do today is try to segue from fish to the universe. And it's a lot to do in 25 minutes, but we'll do our best. I'm a paleontologist, and my research, as well as my writing for a general audience, is infused with the idea that a knowledge of history changes the way you see the world. A knowledge of history is like wearing a new pair of glasses, where the familiar becomes changed. And it happens for the biological world as much as it does the geological as well as the cosmic world as well. As we see history, one of the sort of take-home messages of what I'll be saying today, what history reveals are connections. Connections that are unexpected, sometimes surprising, but all supported by evidence. And the connections we see as we look at history, whether it's through fossils or DNA or embryos or rocks or stars or the cosmos beyond, that history we see links us as people, that our bodies, to understand the formation of our bodies, means understanding over 3 billion years of the history of life, means understanding over 4.5 billion years of the history of our planet and the solar system, and understanding over 13 billion years of the universe. Sounds like a tall order, and it is. But let's start very simply. What I'd like to do is begin with fish, because that's what I'm very comfortable with. And we'll tell you how we discover fish, because this history, and what's special about it, is this history as we've known since Darwin is knowable. That is, we can use the tools of science to make predictions about where to discover our past and our links to that past. And that's what I've done for my career, and I want to give you a flavor for that, because that discovery, which I'm going to tell you about, links us to the rest of the life on our planet, just like every fossil does. Mine's no different, actually, but it's one I found. And then we're going to step back from the Big Bang, and we're going to work through some select events over 13.7 billion years. So it's a lot to do. We're going to do our best in the allotted time. This diagram, I should say, inspired my research for the past 25 years. I saw it in graduate school, and what you see here is a diagram I saw in my second year of graduate school. The professor showed it in a seminar on the great transitions of evolution. And he showed this slide, and I remember it captured my interest. And the reason why it captured my interest is because it encapsulated one of the great challenges in evolutionary biology, that is understanding the transition from life in water to life on land, an event that we think happened, within about 375 million years ago. What you see on top is a cartoon of a lobe-finned fish, one of the closest cousins of limbed animals, those animals that walk on land. It's a cartoon of a fossil. Those fossils were about 390, 380 million years old. And what you see on the bottom is a cartoon of an early limbed animal, a so-called tetrapod, or an amphibian to some. That's a fossil from about 365 million years old. And I remember looking at this thing, you look at a fish body and you look at a tetrapod body, and boy, they look different, right? And not only that, they live in different places, water, land, major transition. Everything has to change. But the reason why I went to graduate school and the reason why this diagram inspired me so much is that this transition is knowable, and we can know it by finding fossils, by comparing DNA, looking at embryos, multiple lines of evidence. My patch of this, starting in graduate school, was to try to find a fossil that bridges this gap. Like other people in the field, we attempt to do this. And what I did is I pulled out the paleontological playbook. You know, you have a problem and a question. How do you answer it? Well, the playbook for an expeditionary paleontologist is, if you want to find new fossils that tell you about transitions, look for rocks in the world that have three properties. That is, they have rocks of the right age to answer whatever question interests you, rocks of the right type to hold those fossils. Not every kind of rock preserves fossils equally well. Either the creatures didn't live in that environment that the rocks were formed in, or the rocks were formed under the wrong conditions. And the third variable is, it does me no good if those wonderful rocks of the right age and the right type are buried, you know, 5 miles underground. They have to be exposed to the surface. We increase our odds of finding fossils if we have naked bedrock where the bones weather out. So I applied that toolkit, and I was really lucky because the rocks close to my home and my first academic job in the state of Pennsylvania, my first job was in Philadelphia, in the University of Pennsylvania, the rocks close to home were the right age. They were Devonian. They were the right type. They were formed in ancient streams and delta systems. Challenge is they weren't exposed to the surface, but I was really lucky because the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation underwent a new road building project. And as PennDOT put in new roads, you know, if I was really lucky, they'd carve into the Devonian rock of the right places. And it just so happened, about an hour north of State College, Pennsylvania, they carved into some Devonian rocks from ancient delta systems in rocks about 365 million years old. And so the only trick for me was, you know, to get all the insurance waivers, which is a big deal in America. And then finally I was able to stand on these rocks as they carved it away. What you see here is geological heaven to somebody like me. And the reason why I say that is you see it's a road cut. I don't have a pointer, but you can see there's that yellow patch on the cliff there. That's a human being for scale. So it's a big road cut. And you see the strata or layers, you know, piled on top of the one or the other, one on top of the other. What this is a snapshot of an ancient delta system. If you look closely at those rock layers, you'll see channels and rivers, okay? And inside those are preserved fossils. So pretty much as soon as we hit those rocks, we started to find fossils. And the fossils we found were of a variety of kind. These rocks are 365 million years old. We started to find limb bones of early limbed animals. This is a humerus or an upper arm bone. We found femora. We found portions of the shoulder, head, you name it. And through these finds and others in Pennsylvania, we were able to see what that ancient environment was in that road cut in Pennsylvania. Today, you see a road cut like that. But as you know geology, as you interpret the fossils in the rocks, as you know how to interpret the rocks themselves, what you'll see is a thriving ancient delta system. We did this reconstruction with National Geographic in the mid-late 90s. And we find some of the earliest forests and trees. You can see margins of these streams. This environment was an ancient delta system, much like the Amazon delta today, with large fish. That one in the center is about 16 feet long, with teeth the size of railroad spikes. And then there are a variety of other fish you see in there, some small armored ones and some of these limbed ones. Now, the hunt for understanding our past and our links to it really started here for us, because what we realized, my colleagues and I, I'm part of a team, Ted Deschler in Philadelphia, Farris Jenkins at Harvard, what the team realized is that we needed to answer this question, to bridge the gap between fish and a tetrapod, to find essentially a flat-headed fish with fins. To do that, we had to go to rocks older in time. We were in here in Pennsylvania in rocks about 365 million years old. We needed, based on other discoveries in Eastern Europe and Quebec, to hit rocks about 375 million years old. So we pulled out the rule book again, looking for rocks of the right age, the right type, and exposed to the surface. And this diagram, diagrams changed my life for some reason. That's just the story of it. This diagram also changed my life. This is a college geology textbook that I found it was printed in it, and I was having an argument with a friend, and I discovered at the end of this argument this diagram, which I colored in three places. This diagram shows everything you look for when you're a paleontologist trying to bridge the gap between a fish and tetrapod, and I'm not kidding you. What you see here is North America. You see the United States in the center. You see Canada up north. And superimposed on that is an interpretation, the hatch marks and all that stuff, of the depositional environments that the Devonian age rocks, again, the rocks of the right age, the depositional environments in which those rocks formed. So in eastern North America, you had an ancient Devonian seaway. And then these authors identified, unbeknownst to me, this is in a college geology textbook, I knew nothing about this, three areas shown in red of rocks that had ancient delta systems preserved in them. The first of these was what I was just telling you about. It's called the Catskill Rocks, right? There's this ongoing Catskill project. I knew about those, so it kind of confirmed to me that they knew what they were talking about. The second one is East Greenland. really well studied. Those are Devonian Age rocks formed in ancient deltas that the Danes and the Swedes had worked on for a number of years. Indeed, that cartoon I showed you of the tetrapod, the flat-headed creature in the second slide, came from Greenland. Then you can see where I'm going with this, obviously. Extending 1,500 kilometers east to west across the Canadian Arctic were mapped Devonian Age rocks of the right age. This one's 375 million years, so 10 million years older, exactly what I wanted compared to the early ones. They were of the right type, formed in ancient delta systems, and exposed. Because if you know the Arctic, right, if it's not ice, it's a desert. And so you have the rocks exposed to the surface, and they're probably weathering, right? So this launched 13 years of expeditions, which were continuing this summer. What we did is my colleagues and I, Ted Deschler again, Ferris Jenkins, again, our whole team, we had to winnow down the Arctic. It's a vast place. Bones are small. How do you go from the big place to where the fossils are found? Is you hone in on the right geological conditions. And here we were looking for a particular environment in the rocks, sedimentary conditions. It took us 6 years working in the summers. But find a layer, we did. Bones were on the surface. We dug in the layer, found skeleton after skeleton of bone piled one on top of the other. We used our trusty jackhammers. That's Ted on the left up there. That's with his trusty jackhammer. Some graduate students doing the hard work. the layer was exposing itself. Now, this layer was fabulous, and there's a reason why I'm focusing on this relative to the universe within. We'll get there in a second. Is everything changed one day. We had worked this layer for a year. We weren't finding too many new fish. Then my colleague Steve, who you see here on the left, pulls out a rock from this layer. We're all working the layer. You know, we're sort of next to each other. It's about as wide as this this stage here. And Steve pulls out a rock and says, hey, Neil, what's this? And this, I don't have a pointer, but I'll show you. See this V right here? This is everything I was looking for, and I do not exaggerate. This is Devonian Age rocks. This little V, see the V with a little notch in there? I looked at it, and I realized it was an upside-down jaw. In here were teeth, and this is a snout. And it's the snout just not of any fish, but of a flat-headed fish. Remember that second slide I showed you, conical to flathead? Bammo, I had a flat-headed fish with its snout sticking right at me. You know, hearts raced, obviously. Removed this. It took 3 weeks. They come up, and we found four more of them as we excavated that one. They come back in the bottom of a helicopter. There's another first-year graduate student for scale. Came back to... I might seem like an extraordinarily bad advisor to you. I'm sorry, but I'm not. We have a good time. These things come back to the laboratory where they're preparators, and I owe so much to them. Remove the rock grain by grain over a period of months. This is Steve's specimen after 4 months. Okay, rock grain by grain. Look at that. It looks like you have a flat head, right? The snout was here. One orbit, there's another orbit, the eye holes, right? And it looks like that probe is on the back. Another 4 or 5 months go by. The preparator, Fred, a wonderfully talented guy, doesn't drink a whole lot of coffee, has a flat head with eyes on top. Look, it even has a neck. No fish has a neck. And the shoulder is exposing himself. So, you know, just at the time in the United States where we're having this argument over intelligence design creationism, where many people are saying there are no transitional fossils in the fossil record, you know, there's a fish on top, there's a tetrapod on bottom, there's the new fish. And this is a fish we described in Pages of Nature in 2006 and 2008. We have another description of another kind of fish like this, hopefully in the works. And what you can see is there's a flat head with eyes on top, like that early tetrapod. But like a fish, it has scales in its back and fins with fin rays, fin webbing. But like a land-living animal, it has a neck, flat head, and indeed when you open up the fins, you see it has bones that correspond to upper arm, forearm, even parts of a wrist. As paleontologists do need to bring... show and tell. This is Steve's specimen. Oh, a cast of it. So there you go. That's what it is. And that's the power of paleontology. It's a physical object. You know, I can show this to people. There's a power to objects. Power to ideas, too, of course. But, I mean, the ideas give us the means to interpret these objects, of course. But this is what I saw first. There's the V. You know, so that's the idea. I could spend 2 hours talking about how wonderful it is to understand the transition from life in water to life on land. This creature had lungs and gills and so forth. But the real story is the universe within and the inner fish. And the real story that pertains to us is that this transition from life in water to life on land is an important event in the past, but it's made more important by the fact that it's part of our own past, when our common ancestors were fish. That is, many of the structures we see appearing for the first time in this creature, Tiktaalik, and its evolutionary cousins are part of our own bodies. That neck we see for the first time in these creatures is something that was to become our own neck. the proto-wrist we see appearing for the first time in Tiktaalik and its evolutionary cousins is something that was to become our own wrist, and bone, and system after system. And how do we know that? We know that through evidence. We know this through connecting the structures in our arm to the bones in Tiktaalik. It has an arm bone with one bone, two bones, and so forth, much like all land-living animals. We know that by connecting the bones in our head. And the lines of evidence are many. They are the fossils, which you see sort of in schematic form here. But we also have embryology, where we compare the embryos of creatures alive today, as well as developmental genetics, where we can compare the regulatory genes or the patches of DNA that drive the developmental processes. We are connected to the rest of the life on our planet, and indeed, Tiktaalik is just one stopping point. If we look at ourselves and we see the layer after layer of history inside of us, we can connect ourselves first to our primate past, then to our mammal past, our reptile past, our amphibian past, our fish past, all the way to microbes. Layer after layer of over 3 billion years of history lies in every organ, cell, and gene in our body, and that history is noble through the evidence that we find. But that is just the tip of the iceberg, indeed, and the iceberg is also part of our history, because we can trace our history all the way back to the Big Bang, at least the components that make us, the organs and how they're shaped in us. And we can take a tour from the deepest events in our universe to the formation of our planet and so forth. So the Big Bang of 13.6 or so billion years ago is responsible for is obviously the beginning of the expansion and cooling of the universe, which we'll talk about in a second. But we could trace parts of ourselves, much of our constituents, to the moments after the Big Bang, to the formation of the Earth and the formation of the Moon that influenced our branch of the tree of life and influenced all life itself, to changes in the atmosphere that happened billions of years ago, to the actual workings of the planet itself, which influenced our own evolution. Indeed, layer after layer, as I say, of history is embedded in us. It's history, shared history, connections with life, with the planet, with the solar system, and the cosmos beyond. What really changes your viewpoint is when you're a paleontologist or a geologist or a cosmologist, what you come to appreciate. As paleontologists have a window on this, as do other natural historians as well as cosmologists, just how dynamic our planet and our universe is. And that dynamism is captured in us. If we look at the sky, you see lights of every description, right, on a clear night. You don't see it in Chicago or London, but, you know, just go outside the cities. We all witness the majesty of the sky above our heads. Learning to see the sky in new ways gave people the means to think about our past. Learning to see the sky gave us a sense of the vastness of space and time and our place in that vastness that we see above our heads. When you do that, you see the sky is kind of the best analogy is like a forest. When you look at a forest, you see old trees, you see young trees, you see saplings. The same is true with the sky. You see young stars, old stars, and so forth. You see it as a dynamic place. We see stars that have exploded or the remnants of those in supernovae. Indeed, that same dynamism is seen in our planet itself. And I think there's no better statement of that than if you look at Mount Everest. If you look at the top of Mount Everest, what rocks do you see? You find marine rocks, ancient marine rocks, what clearly was an ancient ocean at the top of the world today. There's no better statement that was once an ocean is now the top of the world, just how dynamic our planet is. That dynamism, that uplift, is part of our geological past and captured in us as well. Indeed, if you look at rocks of certain places in the world, what you'll see is beautiful rainforests. But those rocks of certain places in the world are 40 million year old rocks in what is today the barren wastes of Antarctica. So our planet and our universe is amazingly dynamic, and our job as natural historians is to understand that dynamism, but also understand our relationship to it. So let me just do, for the next 10 or 15 minutes, some exemplars of this. 13.7 billion years ago, we are all deeply connected. Everything we see, everything we know, is connected at a single point in space. That single point in space began at the Big Bang to expand the universe, and the universe began to cool. With the expansion and cooling of the universe came in succession many of the fundamental properties of our physical world. First, the forces which bind and repel atoms and their subatomic particles. Then the actual particles themselves. First, the subatomic particles, later the nuclei, which are to form atoms, later nuclei captured electrons, and so on and so on and so on. So over successive time in the rapid expansion in the years following the Big Bang came the sort of physical entities that compose bodies. When we look at the sky, and this is a simplification of a very complex set of phenomena, we see stars at different phases of their lives. Stars at different phases of their lives began after the Big Bang, and many millions of years after the Big Bang. But they began as the force of gravity began to take hold and force the atoms, the atomic nuclei, which were generated about a million years after the Big Bang, together to make new components. Turns out the processes of stellar fusion, which are what generate the heat of the stars and are responsible in large part with other forces for the evolution of stars, underlie the evolution of ever larger, ever heavier, if you will, atomic nuclei that are inside our bodies. The central process to understand how ever bigger atoms come about is this process of fusion, which creates the light of the stars. What creates the light of the stars, as we all know, is a sort of nuclear fusion reaction, and that happens as gravitational forces force nuclei together. As these nuclei come together, they form heavier nuclei, but with a loss of mass, which releases energy according to Einstein's laws. The central point is this process of fusion happens in the body of stars and produces ever larger and larger atomic nuclei. So as we see our past, we are, the atoms in us are related to the fusion reactions that happen in stars, and that is an evolutionary process whereby ever larger ones are produced. My artist, who works in my lab, produced this wonderful diagram, which I think captures so much. That is, if you look at us, we have an atomic composition, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and so forth. We don't have any helium in us. There's a lot of story there. But this is the periodic table. This is, you know, what many of us are entranced by in chemistry class. Others are terrified by. It's organized according to the atomic weight, the atomic number of the nuclei of each of these atoms. The ones on the upper left are the lightest. The ones on the bottom right are the heaviest. Turns out that the evolutionary process of the fusion reactions in stars are such that the lightest ones, like hydrogen and helium, were produced in the million years after the Big Bang. But ever greater associations, or ever larger associations of these, are produced by the reactions inside stars, where they, you know, first consume one fuel, then go to consume another. The stopping point of this ever increase in the size of the atomic nuclei through fusion is really iron, because of the properties of the nucleus, larger nuclei are produced by the rapid explosion or the supernovae of explosion of stars caused by number mechanisms. The key point here is that we are part of a recycling process. The atoms inside our body were once the part of other stars and other solar systems. We are temporary renters of these particles, and after we die, our atoms will be returned to the universe to become parts of other systems. So we are part of a grand cycle of the exchange of atomic nuclei, just like rocks, just like planets, and just like stars. And that's really a very profound thought, that we are deeply connected to the universe and the constituents that make us and what those constituents will be after we pass. But we can trace our history from the moments after the Big Bang to moments of the origin of the solar system, the evolution of the Earth, and indeed the inner processes of the Earth. I don't have time to talk about, you know, those billions of years of history. I want to take two stopping points just to give you things that you haven't thought of before. Maybe thought about them in a different way, but this maybe gives you a different perspective. Our solar system formed as a disk around the sun over 4.6 billion years ago. That event and the sort of interactions that came about from that event are embedded in every part of our body, deeply inside of us, including the workings of our DNA. How do we know that? Well, one narrative begins with this gentleman here, Michel Siffre, a French geologist. He's alive today still. He was a geologist and spelunker, loved caves and studied the geology of caves, and was very adept, physically adept at living in them. Also a fabulous scientist, a great note-taker, an observer of the world around him, he came up with an idea for a fabulous experiment. This is in the early 60s. And this experiment was essentially to live in a cave for 2 months with no clock, no time, no sense of time. How time-dependent are we as a species was his question. So what he did, being a meticulous note-taker, he attached himself to all kinds of devices for what was planned to be 2 months, took notes about when he went to sleep and when he woke up, when he ate, he's French, his libido and all that good stuff. And he had a telephone, and he would call his friends at key moments. He didn't have a clock, right? His friends did on the surface. So he'd call his friends saying, okay, I'm going to bed now, you know, I woke up now, that kind of thing. So they recorded real time. He had no idea what real time was. He gets out of the cave after 2 months, totally blown away. He had no idea what time. He thought he lost 22 days. His perception of time was completely disconnected from reality. Here's the important point. But his body was not disconnected from reality. His body clock was functioning on a veritable 24-hour cycle. And we now know that in the years since Sif, is that we have deeply embedded in us a deep tie to a clock. Our highest alcohol tolerance is around 9 o'clock at night. Well, probably all know that. Lowest alcohol tolerance is in the morning, so you bang per buck is at breakfast. bowels and kidneys are suppressed in the evening, which is great if you live in a sleeping bag in the Arctic. And, you know, you can see in the layer after layer of clocks. Indeed, most of our biology is related to a clock-like function inside of us, of our DNA and proteins. And how do we know that? Well, starting, we can take the physiology of our organs, but one of the great breakthroughs here happened right after Sif's adventure in the cave through studying flies. There's a lab in Caltech that looked at flies, and the reason why they looked at flies is they're fabulous animals to study genetics, as you probably know. You can get many of them. You can breed them. They have all kinds of mutants. You can breed these mutants true. You can isolate the genes and begin to understand something of the biology of how those genes and proteins work. Flies are a fabulous window. One of the great labs in the 60s for this was the laboratory in Caltech of Seymour Benzer. Benzer was a remarkable scientist, and they studied all kinds of mutants. One of his graduate students found an amazing mutant. Found a mutant where the flies had an altered rest activity cycle. You know, flies actually have a rest activity cycle, you know, and they found that this one was shifted. So he bred it true, and it turns out there was a genetic basis for that shift in the rest activity cycle. That was a breakthrough. Because now knowing the gene, it gave other people tools to find other genes that it interacts with, or the proteins that those genes make, and how those proteins work together, and the whole intricate mechanism of these things. And over the last several decades, scientists have been working on this mechanism, and they've uncovered a molecular clock that's written in the activity of DNA. What we have is inside our cells, as well as these flies, a clock where the activity of DNA and proteins rises and falls during the course of a 24-hour cycle. And it happens because of a form of a molecular pendulum. DNA makes proteins. Those proteins interact with the DNA itself and downregulate the DNA. So think about a pendulum. So activity and inactivity of the DNA is based on a kind of a molecular pendulum with many genes and many proteins. That's the internal clock. So if you open a Swiss watch, you know, what you'll see is all kinds of gears, and it'll be bewildering to you. I intentionally chose a very bewildering diagram. It's actually not very bewildering. But if you look at the nuclei and cells and these proteins, there is a, if you will, gears that function as a molecular clock inside the cells of flies, but importantly, of humans as well. Our brain cells, our fat cells, our heart cells, our red blood cells all have DNA-based and protein-based clocks inside them that are not on any cycle, but on a 24-hour cycle. And so powerful is this, is that it explains some of our own mutants. You know, we all know people who are night owls or larks. Some of us stay up late and get up late. They're called college students. The ones who get up early and go to bed early, that's kind of me. There are some people who have mutants of this. In humans, there's a thing called advanced sleep phase syndrome, where individuals who have it can't stay up past 7 or 7:30 at night and get up around 3 or 4 in the morning. They've studied this gene that causes this in Utah, and they found there's actually a genetic basis for it. A change in what's called the phosphorylation of DNA of a particular gene. Turns out that genetic shift is similar to one that causes an altered rest activity cycle in hamsters, which is similar to one that causes an altered rest activity cycle in flies. Deep similarities among animals in a DNA-based and protein-based clocks. Now, there are differences as well. We have more of these genes. They're functioning. But there's a fundamental similarity that lies in animal clocks, and they're all based on a 24-hour cycle. Inside each of us, inside of all animals, indeed all creatures that interact with the planet in particular ways, we have a tie to the spinning of the Earth and its connection to the moon. Because the 24-hour day is the property of the spinning of the Earth, which is in part related to our interaction through the energetic reactions and angular momentum with the rotation of the moon. Interestingly, the Earth is slowing down. So today was 2 milliseconds longer than yesterday. The day has slowed down dramatically in the last 400 million years, and part of that is captured what we see in some of the fossil record. So the solar system itself is embedded, and our interactions with the solar system is embedded deeply in our biology. And just to close with one more brief example, is that we know that the variation of the orbit of our changes, of the Earth changes over time. That is, if we look at the Earth, the shape of our orbit varies, the wobble and tilt of our planet varies, on a cycle of tens or hundreds of thousands of years. Some of these cycles relate to major climate changes in the planet, such that they interact, these cycles, which happen every 100,000, 40,000, 20,000 years. Some of these cycles occasionally interact to produce periods of glaciation, of the retreat and fall of the ice from high and low latitudes. Indeed, this glaciation, the retreat and fall of ice, which is itself related in part to the various changes in the orbit of the Earth, has been a major factor influencing human evolution and human history itself. So these factors, which have been central to the evolution of our species in East Africa, as well as human history since then, are related to variation of changes in the Earth's orbit, which, by the way, themselves are related to the interaction of our planet's orbit with the orbit of the largest planet of our solar system, Jupiter. So in a very real sense, the ends of this chain of logic seem so utterly bizarre, but if you follow each chain, part of the chain, it makes total sense, and there's evidence to support it, that our history, our human biology, has been influenced by glaciation, which has been influenced by changes in the Earth's orbit, which itself is influenced by interactions in the solar system itself. And story after story emerges when we look at the world this way. So much so that, you know, it's useful to ask is, what has science done for us in the last 500 years or so? How has it changed our perception of our place in nature, in the cosmos, and so forth? You think about what Copernicus did. You know, he booted our planet from the center of the solar system, right? He put the sun at the center of the solar system. We rotate around the sun. So our special perch was removed in an important way. Think about what Darwin and the biologists did, too. They had their say here as well. We're no longer specially created. We're special in a lot of ways compared to other animals. But we're not a special animal in the sense that we are deeply connected to other creatures. We're part of a tree of life that contains billions of other species. We're one twig on this vast tree of life, which contains creatures of every description and function as well. But just as Darwin and Copernicus, as the biological scientists and the physical scientists, have removed us from our special perch, they've done something else. They've connected us to the rest of life, connected us to the rest of the planet, and connected us to the cosmos beyond. To me, that's a very profound gift. Thank you very much.
Well, that's fantastic, Neil. Thank you. One thing that hits me, Neil, in your account is discovery is a really important part of your story. And I'm interested in what insights it's given you into the process of discovery. Because in a sense, your initial discovery, this discovery, is because there was something missing and you knew it was missing and so you went to find it. Other bits of discovery are entirely fortuitous. People are looking for one thing and something completely different comes along. Also, in your story, collaboration is an important part of that. So what has it kind of taught you about how discovery happens in science?
Well, discovery, to me, and that's a big part of the book, but it's also a huge part of my own life, comes about because human knowledge is ever-growing and tentative. I believe that as we propose ideas, and our job as scientists is to refine those ideas, sometimes falsify them, but hopefully improve them. And what does that is discovery. And I think the real test of important ideas is the way they can manifest themselves in the physical world by actually finding an object or making predictions that we can test. So for me, discovery has an aesthetic to it. I love doing it. I mean, it's a profound joy to find a creature like this, as well as other discoveries that I and other colleagues do routinely. But also, discovery, to make discoveries oftentimes means not discovering. I had to spend 6 years of not finding before we found. And that process of trial and error and learning from mistakes is one where I discover about so many things. I discover about geology because I'm homing in. I'm discovering about biology. I discover about myself. You know, there's a human element to this too. You know, when to give up, when not to give up, frustration, you know, personal challenges, and so, teamwork, collaboration as well.
I mean, I suppose I get from this is that when scientists make a new discovery, it's not so much that what they're handing to the rest of the scientific community is a discovery, it's what they're handing to them is a new set of questions, which
that's
are opened up by that discovery.
You hit it exactly right. You know, what we do as scientists is generate ever more powerful and refined questions. Sure, we have data that does that, but the questions never stop. And some people don't fully understand that. I mean, to me, you know, it's the questions that wake me up in the morning and keep me up at night. You know, they're the stuff of science to me. And that's often very powerful. And I'm a failure as much as I'm a success, if not more. I mean, because that's the part of discovery. I go to the Arctic. I mean, we're doing a whole new gig in the Arctic this summer, in a new place, in a new time period. I don't expect to have a lot to show for myself in terms of fossils, but I will have new ideas and new questions. And it's a process that will take us time to get there.
So that must, in a sense, I don't want to drag you into the politics of this country, but that points to the importance of blue sky research, because to fund research. If you only fund research which is close to finding a discovery, you're not going to fund stuff which of your kind. It's
going to take 6 years. I wouldn't be sitting here across from you today if it wasn't for somebody or an institution that funded a crazy idea in 1998. I had nothing. It was literally a fishing expedition. it was an idea. I had nothing to show for myself except for a geological map, one of which I showed you. There were some refined maps that were produced by the Canadian government. I had satellite photos, but it was all that. It wasn't anything tangible. And so somebody funded the idea. Now, let's get into a little politics there, because I think that's germane. If I was just up to U.S. government support, this would have been found. It was private donors. It was institutional support. Nothing existing financial structure doesn't give you the room for it to have a crazy idea, and also the room to run with it a little bit in the face of not finding things, to do the trial and error. So that was what helped here.
Can I ask you a couple of things about how this kind of impacts on your way of thinking and how you think it might impact on wider kind of culture? So one of the things that occurs to me is that you're talking about the past, and it gives one a sense of connection to the past. But I guess that the other thing is it maybe also gives one a sense of fatalism about the future, because human history is such a tiny speck that one of the things you think is... One of the things I was thinking as I was listening to you is we're not going to be around for much longer, in the grand sweep of things, And now we kind of fight and we say, well, we worry about climate change. Do you have a kind of philosophical view which says, well, I kind of realize that all my work and all of this will sooner or later it will crumble, because that's just the way things happen in the grand sweep of time?
Well, I think crumbling is probably the wrong word. I hopefully won't crumble. When you're a paleontologist, you learn that every species has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Right. The only difference is what's the separation in time between the beginning and the end. Every species goes extinct. Every species has its time on Earth, just like every individual has its time on Earth. But they leave descendants. They impact each of those species. Each individual, I don't want to be too karmic about it, but leaves an impact on the planet. And we all have an impact on people, our children, our colleagues, our friends, our society at large, hopefully. Our species has an impact on our species in particular, but each species has an impact on the planet itself and the other species that are connected to that. So, indeed, we will all leave our mark. Hopefully it won't be a crumble. I'm a little more optimistic than that.
And you addressed in your work a kind of missing link in the argument, and you said that it was one of the things that was useful about it was that it would help in the argument against kind of creationism. But, of course, the big missing link that science can't really deal with is consciousness, because that's the thing that separates us from everything else. Are you intrigued by consciousness as the one thing which can't be explained in this kind of evolution, or do you think it can be explained?
I think it can be. I see no limit to human ability to explain and ask questions and provide answers and so forth.
So could you have a model of consciousness which is like your three beasts,
I think,
can find semi-consciousness and full consciousness evolving in that?
I think you hit on that. I think the more we look, the more we find antecedents to everything in other creatures. And I'd be surprised if we don't see antecedents of a consciousness in other... I mean, just go to a zoo. I was in the zoo working on a documentary, actually, on Friday. And I had to spend 4 hours looking at chimpanzees and gorillas. And, boy, you look in their eyes. I mean, it just grabs you, right? And why does it grab you? I mean, there's something in those eyes. And so sometimes understanding these complex and apparently inexplicable things comes down to asking new questions with new technology or new ideas. So I'm really hesitant to say certain questions are unanswerable because if I said that 200 years ago, I'd certainly have been wrong based on what we know today. I mean, and given the pace of scientific change and the power of our technologies and our ideas, who knows what kind of questions we're going to be asking in 300, let alone 3,000 years.
So you think consciousness is ultimately a reducible problem? Because that's what science does. It reduces problems.
I think we'll be able to explain it. Is it really reducible? I mean, is it an emergent property of smaller bits coming together? That I don't know. Yeah.
And then finally, before I open it up, we're doing a project here at the RSA around spirituality, which is a kind of notion of people who don't necessarily have religious beliefs, some don't have religious beliefs, but have a kind of sense of something else beyond that which is explicable, that which is tangible, that which fits into the kind of post-Enlightenment way of viewing the world. Do you think that there's something in your work which connects with that debate around the spirituality, this sense of something beyond it.
Yeah, so I wrote a book based on evidence. You know, so that's what the book's about, discovery stories, and there's no faith in the book in that way. But it ends in a place, I believe, that where I ended today's talk, which is really sort of thinking about our place in nature and in the cosmos. That is, we're deeply connected to other living creatures and the planet and the universe itself. And, I mean, it's hard to think that way and not be affected by what I think is a very beautiful aesthetic that derives from those connections. Now, what you do with that aesthetic is up to you. For me, for my own personal proclivities, is that it means to be a proper steward of the planet. It means to be a proper citizen of the planet. But other people may use that information in different ways. But it's funny, when I wrote the book, it goes through many phases, and so I had a really lousy rough draft, and worked on it a little more, it got better, I tightened it up a bit. And at some point I read it again. I took a break from the book for about 3 or 4 months because I was just too close to it. And took a break from it, came back to it and read it fresh. And I read it, I finished it, it's a pretty Buddhist book. I didn't know it at the time, it wasn't my motive, but it certainly ended in that kind of place. Yeah, definitely.
It's quite interesting. So your work really says that all that is material about you is immortal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The one thing that's not immortal is your consciousness, of course.
Well, I'm not going to go there yet. I don't know.
Okay, so that's quite a deep point to open it up for questions. Feel free to ask more prosaic questions.
Feel free to ask about fish if you want. Yeah. It's all good, yeah.
Okay, who's got a question?
Thanks. Yeah, thank you. That's that was really interesting. And the question I have is you showed a sort of a slide, which was a journey from the Big Bang to Earth forming and then to Europe and so on. And taking that in context of your assertion that the biological clock inside is all 24 hours used to be related to the Earth, day, night, all this rotation, I'm thinking, well, what is the impact on other life forms elsewhere in the universe? You've shown one path, which is us. Where does the part of Earth that, say, reacts to the 24 hours in another universe, or another galaxy, another solar system, how does that... What's the dependency, I suppose?
Well, let me answer it in a couple ways. The first would be, if we humans are to go extra planetary, that is to Mars and beyond. I'll break it up. I'll talk about aliens first, and then I'll talk us as into space. We need to import our planet with us. Obviously, we take that as trivial at some level, that we need oxygen, carbon dioxide, and nitrogen, and we need certain things to survive gravity. But daylight cycles are a piece of us, our biology as well. So any extended trip, we need to, export a piece of our planet, if you will, at least that tie to the planet we have as we go forward. Your question is actually a very general one, and I don't know exactly how to answer it, but let me just refine it a bit and then see if I can. You're looking for the universals of life. I mean, if there's life on another, if you're thinking of life on another solar system in some other galaxy, which is entirely possible because as we discover the universe, like the Kepler mission now, we're seeing all kinds of different worlds, some of which may indeed be habitable. How important is water for life? We take it for granted that water, the water planet is associated with life, and we use that as an indicator, having the ability to have liquid water and water in three phases. Is that a necessity of life? I mean, for the life that we understand, absolutely yes, but that's not necessary. Is that all that there is? I don't know. Also, likewise, carbon-based life. Are there other molecules, are there other atoms that can serve the same role as carbon? Likewise, oxygen is a transducer of electrons and the energetic cascades that go on in life. How important is that? I mean, I think there are generic properties to each of those molecules that could probably be substituted by other kinds of molecules. So it may be indeed that what we're taking as an indicator of life, which is carbon, water, and so forth, is just our particular generic variety of those the specific variety of those more generic properties of the ability to trade electrons, the ability to exist in multiple phases, and so forth. So,
thank you. As a fellow biologist, I thoroughly enjoyed that, and I recognize the solid science of it. I was a little worried about your last two sentences in your presentation, which almost opened the door to what I regard as pseudoscience. You talked of an almost homeopathic influence of other bodies in the solar system.
Oh, I didn't mean that
on
at all.
Life on Earth, somehow. And if you didn't mean it, then the next part of my question is meaningless, which is that almost a scientific basis for astrology?
Yeah, so, oh boy, yeah, okay. No.
Astrology. No, we've had aliens, we've had astrology.
No, homeopathic medicine I don't subscribe to. And vibrations and all that. And astrology neither. I believe in connections that are historical. But... And And those are the most robust. Those are the ones I could show you. I could find artifacts in our bodies and other animals and rocks and so forth. I don't want to push it too far beyond that.
I'm not a biologist, but I am interested. I got a sense, just in some of the things you were saying, that you are irritated and frustrated with the creationists and the intelligence.
That's a very polite way to say it, yes.
Yeah. I suppose my question is, how do you deal with that in America? Because I find it incredibly frustrating.
Yeah. Thank you for asking that. I've got one part
of my family who've suddenly gone off young and believe the world is only 6,500 years old. And how do you deal with it? And do you go head-to-head with them, or what do you do?
Do a little bit of both. Thank you for asking that question, because that's something I think about quite a bit, and I know you're perceptive to pick that up. That's a subtext of some of my work. And also, I think it made that particular fossil, there was a context in which in 2006 when that discovery appeared, it was a lead story in the New York Times. You know, if the fossil was discovered 15 years before, it probably wouldn't have been, because we had hit a creationist moment in America. When I speak to a creationist crowd, my talk is generated towards evidence. I love the tectolic story, and I will actually go through more of that, because I'll talk about how we homed in on the layers and how we knew where to find it. There was luck involved in it, by the way. I didn't want to make it – not entirely planning. We had a significant amount of luck with it. But there was a big planning piece of that as well. And I go into that planning piece because embedded in that planning piece is a kernel of the power of scientific predictions and scientific thinking – and the importance of using somebody else's discovery somewhere else to leverage a new discovery somewhere else in the world. And then I can close with, if they believe the discovery and I'm passing the fossil around and they're holding a physical object, it opens up a kind of conversation that wouldn't have existed otherwise. Now, is that conversation successful in terms of changing somebody's embedded point of view? In most cases, probably not. But at least it gets them to consider it. The most challenging piece of that, of the creationist conversation, is you and I can have a conversation and we can agree on the standards by which we can argue, converse, and be right or wrong. And I think that's what science is based on. We have this conversation of shared, not always, but there is this perception that we can improve by sticking to the right ideas, disproving ones that are less correct. It's hard to have that conversation where somebody just doesn't accept the value of evidence but accepts the value of sort of revealed truth or eternal truth that is unchangeable. So, again, in those cases, I focus on the discovery story because that's a universal we can talk about. In some cases, it helps, in most cases, it doesn't. So it can be very frustrating.
Thank you, Michael Kipp. Fascinating talk, really interesting. Not quite sure how to phrase the question, but I sense there's an assertion that we're kind of related to lots of stuff right back to Big Bang, and there's lots of species that we know, hamsters you mentioned, which are also kind of related to us. I think we kind of recognize that. But on our planet, are there things that are not related to us, which I dare to use the word alien, but are there other life forms which do not conform to that connection that you so eloquently described?
Right. So, it's there. So the question you're asking is, does life on our planet share a common ancestor, all living things? And that's a very open question. So one of the powerful tools that have emerged over the past, say, 30 years is obviously we now have the ability to compare DNA, RNA, nucleotides in a manner that's the source of data we didn't have before. So we can now look to see similarities and differences. The problem is that we go to some of those very deep branches of the tree of life, it's hard to make comparisons among creatures. I think the existing body of research is that life has a common history, but that can easily be a single ancestor, but that could easily be wrong, and that the more we learn about science, the more we see that the independent evolution of certain traits, and indeed even life itself, may have happened independently, if you have the right context, the right environmental context, and the right substrates acting, it may not be impossible to have multiple, transitions to a common state. And we know that happens at lower levels of evolution, but at that highest level, it may be indeed. I don't know. We have to admit that possibility.
I'm also quite interested by your research and various discoveries and what you had been saying earlier. But you also mentioned that you went to the zoo and been looking at these
chimpanzees, and gorillas and gibbons.
And you had been looking at their eyes also, and you see things different from their various eyes. So what do you see in your fellow colleagues?
Well, here's what happens.
You see something different in their eyes?
So well, that my colleagues probably watching this, so I can't talk about what a faculty meeting is like and comparing it to the zoo. But I'll give you one anecdote, though. I had a couple hours to kill while they were setting up the film crew, and I had my iPad just to kill the time. And I'm looking at the chimpanzees, and on the iPad just shifting around. And one of the chimps comes to the. I'm standing at the window here, just looking at him, just doing stuff. And one of the chimps comes and starts to try to touch the iPad. I don't know. That kind of changed me.
This is this book and your previous book. They are beautiful books. They're inspiring books. And I have this thing, which is, why do you think it is that we persist with introducing children to science by teaching them most boring stuff at the beginning?
Yeah, exactly.
No, but really,
I know,
is this changing? Because I've always believed if you talked to 5, 6, and 7-year-olds about this stuff, okay, in kind of accessible ways, it just blows them away. And then they're willing to do the rather boring stuff of learning the periodic table. But we start kids off in science with really tedious stuff, generally speaking.
I mean,
and they have to work really hard before they get to the... Now, I would say to anyone, if you've got a 10, 11, 12-year-old, whatever, is thinking about whether or not to do science, later on in school, get them this book, because they will read this book and they'll go, I want to do this. This is mind-blowing, Why is that happening?
I don't know. I think we're...
Am I right that we don't?
No, you're most definitely right. And it's something I think about a lot. Involved in science education in America, significantly, through the National Academy. It's a paradigm shift. Because, what we are shifting to in many fields of science, so there is some progress here. That is, we're shifting to more an example-based science. Because when we... exemplars, evidence-based science, where we can use examples of discovery, which have human discovery stories part of that, it is a wonderful entree. And that does inform the book. The challenge is we have a curricular establishment, and often a need in some cases, where there is, national exams, where students have to do certain, have to master certain abilities, and that runs counter to this other effort, which is sort of to teach science as its discovery tools. I can tell you from personal example, when I was talking in my daughter's school on Monday in Chicago, and, I was telling them the Tiktaalik story, much like the same I was doing here. I mean, you could do it at all age groups. And there are elements that appeal to each age group. Each one takes its own message out of it. But it works at these different levels. And I think you bring up a very important point, and I would like to see it change.
I think what went wrong is that the people thought the reason kids don't engage in science is it's not practical. So then they started doing science that's about stuff that's around you, energy and things like that. And, okay, I understand that. I don't think that's what really gets kids. What gets kids is wonder. And your books are full of wonder. They're not full of practicality, really.
Not at all, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. Yeah, but my parents complain about that all the time.
And it's that wonder that we've got to tap into young people.
I think the wonder piece of science is huge. And I think the science is... I know this sounds cliche, but there's an awe to the whole enterprise. Mm-hmm. Think about when you're doing science, you don't get that sense of awe. I'm cracking a rock. I'm taking the rock, looking at it, and I find a fossil, I throw it over my shoulder. There's not a lot of awe in that process. But there's every now and then a day where Steve says, hey, what's this? Or a colleague finds something, and I read about it in the pages of Nature. There's a moment of awe that hits me. And every now and then you do step back and say, holy cow, yeah, this is really cool. And I think that's what we have to fuse into our kids, and we need to do a better job of it.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. It's a wonderful... I'm afraid I will take from today some worries about the RSA audience, because the moment of greatest interaction was when you put the picture of the hamster up, and everyone went, oh. So slightly worried about the intellectual caliber of our audience today, but no, the questions were fantastic. So it's a great book, and don't forget, when you'll now know that the book and you are indivisible, you're all parts of the same stuff, you can have an intimate relationship with the book. So thank you for coming. Thank you for the great questions that you've asked. Just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking Neil Shubin.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.